You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Great to be with you this lunchtime for The Country Hour. After closing down in December because of a range of issues, we can tell you today that the meatworks at Goonbalunya is back in business.
We have put in place a new management team and we're committed to working, continue the operation throughout this year and beyond. There's approximately 200 head of cattle in the on the floodplain there, ready to be processed through the meatworks.
Yeah, steaks, sausages, it's all happening again at Goonbalunya. We'll learn more about that soon. We'll also today check out the latest batch of crocodiles that are hatching at Crocodilus Park. And we'll be heading to Matarenka, where on the weekend, kids from right around the region saddled up for rodeo school.
How did it feel when you were on the back of the potty?
Fun. And I was a little bit scared. I didn't think I can ride the thing, but I was ready.
You didn't think you could do it?
Yeah, right. But I just was it.
Future rodeo stars at Matarenka. That story coming up before 1:30. Make sure you stick around. And if you'd like to get in touch with the program, a reminder that our text number is 0487 99 1057. But first up today, we are talking about onshore gas. With the Territory's current moratorium on fracking, you'd be forgiven for thinking there's not much happening in this space, but there is. There's a lot happening, with the NT's largest onshore gas producer ramping up its production in a big way. The company Central Petroleum will soon be drilling 4 new wells to source gas for the Northern Gas Pipeline. And because it's using conventional methods to extract the gas, the moratorium on fracking doesn't affect the company, doesn't affect its exploration or its production plans. It's business as usual. The Country Hour was granted access to Central's Marini Gas Field and Processing Plant, which is about 250 km west of Alice Springs. We were invited there to see how the product is sourced and to find out where it ends up. Katrina Bevan has the story.
The Marini gas field has gone through a number of changes in its 30 years. More recently, company Santos sold half of the venture to Central Petroleum in 2015 and then sold the other half to Macquarie in 2016. In Central Petroleum's words, the field has been capital starved for many years, but the company says soon that will all change. With new markets opening up, and a supposed East Coast gas shortage looming. Today I'm here to see where it all begins and take a closer look at where a large part of the Territory's gas comes from. I'm standing at the East Marini No. 7 well, and with me is James Van Royen, the Operations Manager for Central Petroleum.
The Marini field, we're a little blessed, is classified as a conventional field. So in reality, we're looking at millions and millions of years of deposition, organic material decay, that generates hydrocarbons. Those hydrocarbons are trapped in a sandstone formation. So in reality, we don't have to, in this well here, for example, we haven't had to stimulate. So basically, the steel casing, the simplest analogy is a whole series of steel casings, and the final tubing acts like a straw. We effectively poke it into we drill it into the sandstone. We then reduce the pressure at surface and the natural reservoir pressure drives the hydrocarbon into the steel tubing and out. We don't need to pump it. We don't need to frack it. It's conventional, so in reality, we don't have to do the hydraulic stimulation that everybody's talking about here.
And that's the case for all of your gas extraction on Marini?
They have trialled hydraulic fracturing here in the past, but at this current present time, we have no intention of stimulating the reservoirs because the reservoir is doing what it should be doing and it's flowing naturally. If there's naturally occurring fractures, that's fantastic. It means that we don't have to stimulate it. Nature's done a much better job than we could ever do.
Now that the gas has been taken out of the well, it's piped to the processing plant, where the gas, oil and water that's been taken out of the ground will be separated.
So this is actually the arteries feeding back into the central treatment plant. The treatment plant then separates the crude, any production water and gas. The gas is stabilised and treated and is exported into the Amadeus pipeline. Similarly with the crude, we remove any gas from the crude or remove any water from the crude. The crude is stabilised before being stored, and then the Inland Oil, IOR, come and pick up the crude from us, and it's then exported as well from the Marini plant.
And the water?
The water is evaporated. So the water is a natural byproduct of the process. The gas wells also produce a little bit of water. So any of that production water is separated from the oil and gas. The water is then sent down to our treatment ponds where it sits there and it's evaporated.
To separate the products, the plant uses a few methods, including gravity and also temperature. After separation, the gas pressure is then modified to make it suitable for the Amadeus pipeline. About 15 terajoules of gas a day is sent through the pipeline from Marini. And just to put that in perspective, according to Central Petroleum, that's enough gas to supply three towns about the size of Alice Springs for one day.
So the Amadeus gas pipeline is a north-south running pipeline purely to the Northern Territory. It runs from Darwin to Alice Springs. So we supply gas from here. It goes into Alice or it goes further up. So we're currently supplying MacArthur River Mine. From one of our other fields, we're also supplying the Owen Springs Power Station in Alice Springs. So yeah, so it goes along to a few customers along the way.
And domestic use as well?
We don't have domestic contracts at this current point in time. So we have two main contracts, which is EDL and MacArthur River Mine and the Owen Springs Power Station. So at the moment, we're probably supplying the industrial users. But in reality, our gas goes into the pipeline where the physical molecules go. Is not up to us, that's up to APA. So in reality, we're probably supplying some of the domestic market as well, but at the moment we've got our big contracts with the industrial users.
With the new gas market emerging with the Northern Gas Pipeline, Central's plan is to up the production from 15 terajoules a day to more than 60. But there are a few hurdles to jump, according to Managing Director Richard Cotty.
Well, the whole thing is presently at Marini is conditioned on an ACCC approval for joint marketing to allow Marini to be sold as one unit. It will produce about 20 petajoules into the eastern seaboard market, and is a market of 2,000 petajoules, so it's about 1% of the market. So that's a hurdle that hopefully goes away at the end of this month. But what we will be doing is totally increasing the capacity. Originally, this site was at 50 terajoules a day at its peak in 2009. We're hoping to actually bring it up to 63 terajoules a day. And that's dependent to some extent on the Western Marini 26 well, which is trying to harvest a whole new zone, which is actually closer to the surface. But because gas had no market, we always drilled through it, so we know the gas is there.
Another hurdle is getting rid of a large gas flare that's been burning for 30 years, because according to Central, previous companies found it wasn't viable to fix and the gas couldn't be put to use. But Richard Cotty says in 6 months' time, that flare, it'll be gone.
Basically, there's a hydrocarbon chain, and C1's the stuff that's used as natural gas, C3 and 4 are the LPGs, and C5 plus is start to go liquids. Given the small amount of quantities that you have, there is no home for those fractions in between. Technology has moved since then, and so it is possible now to harvest the LPGs and condensates out of it and commingle the condensates with the crude that we're selling.
6 months you think it'll take to fix that?
If you come out this time next year, you won't recognise the place.
Yeah, well, lock us in for that. That was Richard Cotty. He's the Managing Director of Central Petroleum, speaking to Katrina Bevan. You can read more about what's happening out there at Marini right now if you go searching for NT Country Hour. It is 20 minutes to one. Well, he's gone from being a little-known MP to the country's Deputy Prime Minister overnight. The new Nationals leader, Michael McCormack, he concedes he's got a big challenge ahead, having taken over from Barnaby Joyce amid scandals that have engulfed his party and the federal government. But he insists his party will now unite behind him as they seek to stop talking about themselves and instead focus on issues affecting regional Australia. From Parliament House, Brett Worthington reports.
So I'd like to introduce the new leader of the Federal National Party, Michael McCormack.
Riverina MP Michael McCormack jumps from a second-tier ministry to one of the most senior roles in Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's cabinet. But brand recognition for the new Deputy Prime Minister is a far cry from the party's former leader, Barnaby Joyce, one of the few politicians with first-name recognition across the country.
Okay, Michael, you're keeping the seat warm for Barnaby until such time as he can mount a comeback.
I have been elected to do the job by the National Party. As I said, Barnaby Joyce will play an important part in our party and in our nation going forward, and I look forward to working with him to overcoming some of the challenges that is faced by rural and regional people.
New South Wales MP David Gillespie last week said he would nominate but ultimately pulled out, and that paved the way for the rise of the 53-year-old Michael McCormack, a newspaper editor turned federal politician in 2010. He takes over Barnaby Joyce's transport and infrastructure portfolios, leaving behind Veterans Affairs, a role he's held since late last year. Famously, he was the minister responsible for the census, which sparked controversy when the website crashed.
I am a team player, and I'm going to be doing it with the very best team in rural and regional Australia who serve the interests of our nation, and particularly of those people who live in rural, country, coastal and regional areas here in Canberra.
Barnaby Joyce arrived at the party room meeting flanked by Deputy Leader Bridget McKenzie and New South Wales Senator John Wacker Williams. Michael McCormack arrived alone, as did recently demoted Victorian MP Darren Chester and the newly promoted Agriculture Minister David Littleproud, both who'd been touted as possible leaders ahead of today's vote.
So I want to thank each and every one of the National Party members for the faith that they've shown in me. I want to make sure that people know that in me they will have a fighter. I have a huge challenge ahead of me. We have a huge challenge ahead of us as a government, as a Nationals and Liberals coalition government.
Standing in the very back corner with the photos of his predecessors hanging high above him, Barnaby Joyce barely reacted as the man who replaced him spoke. He looked straight ahead and rarely shifted his gaze as speakers heaped praise upon him.
I want to place on record the an acknowledgement for Barnaby Joyce. He has been an outstanding leader. His service to our party and to our nation will never be diminished. His legacy will endure.
After winning the vote, Michael McCormack met with the Prime Minister, who was keen to speak of the longevity of the federal coalition.
Well, Michael, congratulations.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Looking forward to continuing our very strong and successful coalition.
Well, the Liberal Party has been in partnership with the Nationals for all of its life. And if you include the predecessor parties of the Liberal Party...
Quite an innings of achievement and delivery, and we'll continue that.
Yeah, we certainly
long
will.
Long into the future.
Yeah.
With the swearing-in complete, the new Deputy Prime Minister has made it clear that he hopes his colleagues will stop talking about themselves and instead focus their attentions on issues afflicting regional Australia and the policies of those in the opposition.
Bill Shorten would be the worst outcome for Australia. He is aligned to militant trade unions. He is aligned to the Greens. He says one thing when he's campaigning in Queensland. He will certainly be saying another thing when he's campaigning in Batman. We do not need a Bill Shorten government, and we are committed as Nationals, along with the Liberals, to do everything in our power to make sure that we stay in government so that those jobs can continue.
There he is, the new leader of the Nationals, Michael McCormack, ending that report from Brett Worthington. We wait and see. A new era there for the Nationals. It is 17 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Up next, we're heading to Goombalunya out there in Arnhem Land. There's some good news for the local meatworks. You might remember it was closed down in December. Few issues out there. Well, things have been sorted. It's back in action, as we'll learn in a moment. And we'll also be making our way to Crocodilus Park to check out the latest batch of baby crocs. All that coming up right after this tune by the man himself, Slim.
By the plains of old Pembina, where the old Moyle River flows.
What a great thing to have on a Monday. Bit of Slim Dusty Plains of Peppermint Yardy here on ABC Radio right across the territory. Some good news on the Country Hour. The meatworks in the community of Goombalunya is back up and running again after its manager was sacked and workers temporarily laid off in December. It is back and running. The closure left the Arnhem Land community without a local meat supply and abattoir workers without an income in the lead up to Christmas. It was a real issue out there. But the chief executive of Australian Indigenous Agribusiness, which leases the Gunbalunya Meatworks, he says the abattoir ended up being closed for, in the end, only about 3 weeks.
And some of that was associated with an annual shutdown period, plus we had some repairs and maintenance that we had to undertake with some meat processing equipment and cold room facilities. But it opened again, the operation started again on the 8th of January.
People from Gunbalunya said late last year that they were worried about when it closed, that there was a lack of local meat supply in the community. Were there efforts made to keep the meatworks open?
So in terms of meat supply, there was meat in supply in the local store there in Gunbalunya community. Certainly made some contact with the local store there, and there was certainly some meat supply there. Obviously, starting back in 8th of January, that meant that we could start processing meat in terms of fresh meat for the community, and we're processing at a rate of about 10 head per week, and that's while the wet season is in full swing, and then we'll start to increase the supply once the access opens up to roads to Darwin.
And those workers who were out of work there as it closed down, are they all back at the meatworks?
Yes, so we have about 10 people. As at the end of January, there's 10 people employed at the meatworks, and six of those are in Indigenous people. They're back at work. So on the 8th of January, work started to clean up the facilities and get preparation for processing meat for the community. So that took approximately a week, and then so there's people employed to undertake that, but there's people employed as a part of the operations now in terms of processing meat.
The board of the Gunbalunya Meat Supply had called and had written a letter to the ILC for the previous manager of the meatworks to be reinstated. Are you able to give us an idea of where discussions with the Gunbalunya Meat Supply are up to?
Yes. So, Dan, I went up to Gunbalunya in early January, I think the first week in January, to meet with directors of the board there just to talk about the operations and what was lying ahead, and I guess to talk about any issues that they're on their mind associated with the operations. So that took place there. I guess it was an opportunity to let people know that the operations had started at that point, and we're committed to working continue the operations throughout this year and beyond. There was, we're reiterating that there's approximately 200 head of cattle in the on the floodplain there, ready to be processed through the meatworks, and that we have put in place a new management team, and that team consists of some existing managers of that business that have now been promoted, as well as a promotion of a local Indigenous production manager there in Thomas Gadari.
The board also expressed some concern that local workers at the cattle station had been laid off, and that station hands were brought in from other parts of the territory. Is Australian Indigenous Agribusiness committed to employing local workers in that community?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have agreements in place that state our commitment around local employment, and if there are instances where the ability to fill positions of local employment. We've had now a couple of meetings with the GMS board to talk about if we do need to bring in outside help, what that might look like and how they feel about that. So, but in short, we're certainly committed to local employment there. That was one of the drivers of starting the business in the first place.
Craig North, what's the outlook for the cattle station there at Gunbalunya as you see things going along in the wet season at the moment?
Yeah, it's very wet now, Dan, very wet indeed. I think we've had about 1,500 mil of rain overall for this wet season, and about 430 of that's been up until February. So we're quite wet there at the moment. So, but the meatworks, as I've just touched on, is up in operation, and that'll increase in production as access to markets open in the next couple of months. And then we'll be looking at what cattle we have on the floodplain, both for the supply of the meatworks and as well as general growing cattle for the business for 2018. So both businesses, you know, are looking well. There's certainly plenty of rain. We're currently actually looking at the way that we operate these businesses in the future, and you know, to maximise their financial performance and benefits for the community.
It's Craig North. He's the Chief Executive of Australian Indigenous Agribusiness, which is a subsidiary of the Indigenous Land Council, speaking there to Dan Fitzgerald with the good news that the meatworks out there at Kunbalanya is back up and running.
Liz Travascus.
Sticky Germans might be the solution to our population woes in the Northern Territory. Anita, are you a sticky German?
Definitely, yes. Migrants looking for the big outdoors, adventure, beautiful scenery.
And we've got it all.
This afternoon from 3.
I'm not a sticky German, but I'm a sticky Victorian, and part of the reason I moved here was because I never wanted to scrape ice off my windscreen.
Yep, I agree with you on that.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
You're tuned into the Country Hour right across the territory on ABC Radio. And if you need to duck out in the paddock for whatever reason, you can always download our podcast. Now, for crocodile farms in the territory, it's been a bit of a tricky wet season. The late start to the wet meant a lot of the crocs out there in the wild actually delayed laying eggs. And then when we got those record rains in January, a lot of the eggs were washed away. I went along to Crocodilus Park, which this year is expecting to hatch up to 3,000 baby crocs. And I caught up with croc man Tom Paulson just at a great time because there were a few little baby crocs poking out.
Hi, Matt. I'm Tom from Crocodilus Park. We're in the incubator area now, looking at a few of the little hatchlings that have come out this year. This group now is some crocs that we've bred from the park.
And they're fresh out of the egg.
Yeah, they're just hatching as we speak. We just helped three little guys out of the eggs.
Tell me about when they come out. They've got this little bit of bone on the top of the nose. What's that all about?
They do have a little bit of growth on the tip of their nose that will help them out of the egg, help them break through a rather tough membrane and a shell. That helps them out of the egg, but they soon their snouts soon straighten up and they get swimming as soon as they can.
How long can it take for a baby croc to get out of that egg?
Generally it's pretty fast, but it can take up to 3 or 4 hours for them to motivate themselves to get out of the egg. Yeah. Depends how fit they are when they hatch.
So we've got a bunch of them in front of us. They're only, what, 10, 15 centimetres long, about that?
These guys will be about 20, 25 centimetres
20, 25.
Long. 25 centimetres long.
And they've already got that look in their eye, Tom, I reckon. Yeah, they'd love to eat us if they could.
Oh, definitely. They're definitely looking for some food. As soon as they get out, they're looking for anything small and tasty that can snap up.
So what is the first meal that a baby croc like this will get?
They'll generally go for small invertebrates, small fish, that sort of thing. Ideally fish, lots of nice calcium in there to help their bones develop.
And that's what you'll feed to them on a farm like this?
We generally feed them minced up chicken heads with calcium and multivitamins just to make sure they've got a good start.
How long have the eggs been hatching for?
Our first group started hatching early January from eggs that were laid late October or mid-October. Mm-hmm. And these guys would have laid December.
These little fellas have been sort of born and bred on the park, but you do collect eggs from the wild. What's it been like this year? Because it has been a bit of a funny wet season.
It has been a bit difficult. We have managed to collect quite a few eggs, Adelaide River mainly, before the major floods through there. Most of those eggs that we left or that we don't disturb would have been lost now. Right. So it'll be very few hatching this year in the wild, but we did manage to collect quite a few eggs out there.
And it is a crocodile farm. The end game's all about the skin. What's in store for these guys over the next, few years?
We'll look after these guys very nicely over the next 4 years. They grow quite fast. We incubate them at 32 degrees to make sure that we get a high percentage of males come out of the eggs. We look after them and make sure they are happy as possible. And we grow them up in the different pens around the park and keep them at the density that they're happiest at, because they are very social animals until they're about 1.2 to 1.4 meters long. which is when they naturally start dispersing and becoming solitary.
And just looking at these little fellas at the moment, have you ever been nipped by one of these little blokes?
Oh, the little guys quite often.
Yeah.
They're very friendly, but you have to be careful. Obviously, as they grow, you've got to be a lot
more careful. But at this age, what's the pain barrier? What are we looking at?
Minimal.
Okay.
They don't draw blood at this age.
Beauty. Well, it's been awesome to stand here and see these little guys in action. Thanks so much for showing us.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, big thanks to Tom Paulson. He's from Crocodilus Park. Those little guys scurrying around in the kitchen sink. Awesome to see him in action. We'll put a few pictures and videos up on our Facebook page a little bit later on this afternoon so you can check it out for yourself if you go searching for NT Country Hour.
Yeah, I'm Dave Shepherd. I'm at West Elsie. I've been up here for 28 years now and I'll be here for a lot longer. You're listening to the Country Hour.
0487 99 1057 is our text number at the Country Hour. Mark says the new Nationals will be the same as the old one. No value to the NT and unfit to be part of the federal government on account of having zero interest in spending time outside of Queensland and New South Wales, says Mark. And we got a call from Juno in Catherine who says she doesn't understand why Central Petroleum is ramping up gas production when the world is moving away from fossil fuels. Some of your thoughts on what you've been hearing today on the Country Hour. After the 1 o'clock news, we'll be speaking to the Weather Bureau, try and get an idea of the week ahead. And we'll be hearing from the NT Cattlemen's Association and some fears that changes to the national trucking laws will see animal welfare responsibilities palmed to the wayside. And what would that mean for industry? We'll talk about it soon here on the Country Hour. But it's now news time, 1 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Viv Oldfield from Crown Point Parcel Company and I love listening to the Country Hour with Matt Brett.
While I remember it, a big thanks to everyone who came along to the Crobbery Tavern on Friday to see the Country Hour broadcasting from the side of the pub. We had a ball, didn't we, Lydia? How good was it? And I hope you enjoyed it as well if you're tuning in from wherever you are in the territory. Good fun there. And we heard some amazing stories about what that community's been up to, especially during that period when the Arnhem Highway was cut for 12 days. Did you hear the farmer who told the story about moving 10 tonnes of fresh fruit and veggies, boating it across the flooded Adelaide River? Crocs popping up and trying to grab a feed of okra. It was a ripper of a yarn. You can catch it on the podcast if you missed it. Hey, still to come before 1:30, saddle up because we're heading to Mataranka Rodeo School.
There is a little varmint potty calf getting its rope on now in shoot red.
Wee, hold on. That's coming up before 1:30. Make sure you stick around for that. Let's make our way to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. How are you, Sally?
Oh, not too bad, thanks.
Bit of a rodeo expert yourself. A few buckles in the old trophy cabinet. No? Okay. Hey, it's a pretty lovely afternoon in the Red Centre.
Yeah, it's only about 31, 32 degrees. 31 in Alice, 32 in Yulara. 33 in Tennant Creek.
Given so, what it's been.
Oh, yeah.
You'll take that.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's we're looking at temperatures getting up to potentially up to 36 today, though it's better get a bit of a wriggle on because that's got another 5 degrees to go.
Yeah.
But it's certainly going to be much more pleasant down through that area than we have had. Unfortunately, it's not going to last. We're seeing those temperatures creep up again, so it's back up to 38 by midweek, and then as we go into the weekend, so we might even see a 39 on Saturday. So, unfortunately, we enjoy the cool while it lasts, but also you probably aren't going to see that much rain down through that area. There's a slight chance we might see some down sort of through the eastern parts of the territory sort of later in the week, but at this stage it's only a slight chance.
Okay, and what about the week ahead for those in the top end?
Oh, in the top end, we're going to see those showers and storms continuing, probably more frequently over the western top end. The temperatures are going to still be sort of around and about. So at 10, Darwin, it's got sitting on 31, 32 at the moment. The as far as forecast goes, 32 for today, 30, and then we're just sitting on 32. If you're going so a little bit further afield, it's just got to find the right. So looking at temperature, well, Catherine, we see temperatures sort of 36s, 35s today, 36s over the next few days, maybe easing off slightly, but generally it's still going to be pretty warm sort of inland, and we're just looking at those showers and storms, so we're not guaranteed, you're not guaranteed to get a shower or storm to cool you down.
Yeah, right. I got told by our reporter Dan Fitzgerald that the weekend in Mataranka was an absolute stinker. Even the magpie geese were sweating.
Well,
awful.
That's, yeah, if even the magpie geese aren't coping, it's...
there has been some nice, there's been a bit of rainfall in the last 24 hours. What are some of the highlights there?
Oh, there's been a bit. Supplejack Station was the highest. I just keep on losing my mouse, so to bear with me. Hang on, where did it go? I'm using somebody else's setup, so I can't find the rainfall. I think they had about 30 mils.
34 millimetres of Bullow River as well.
Yep.
That's good.
Yep. Yeah, it's been fixed for me. 25 mils at Supplejack, yep. 34 at Bullow River, as you said, and also La Belle. And Favec Range out in the MacArthur Rivers was the top with 37. Then they drop off fairly quickly. So Riverine had 18, Brunette Down 17, Elliot 16, Foulshed Land 10. So, but even Rabbit Flats at 8 mils. So it depends on where you are. The totals haven't been that big, but so those through so the central parts of the territory haven't been too bad for that area.
Beautiful. Now, any warnings we need to be aware of, Sally?
No warnings at this stage. As always, we're keeping a close eye on everything and we'll put any out if need be, but at this stage, we don't actually need any.
Yep. Lovely. Well, you have yourself a wonderful afternoon.
That's okay. Thanks.
That is Sally Cutter at the Bureau there. It is 10 minutes past one here on the Country Hour. The NT Cattlemen's Association has expressed concern over the introduction of chain of responsibility into the national heavy vehicle laws. Now, while the territory operates under a slightly different system and won't be directly affected by these national changes, they will apply to cattle producers who use trucks from interstate or send stock interstate, which, if you think about it, means quite a few territory cattle producers. CEO of the NT Cattlemen's Association, Paul Burke, says he's worried the chain of responsibility will water down animal welfare standards.
So the pastoral industry in the Northern Territory and the NTCA fully believe that the person that actually ultimately has responsibility for those cattle at any one time are the people that are looking after them. So on the property, the pastoralist is responsible for getting those cattle ready to transport, making sure they're fit to load, and assisting in that loading process. Once those cattle are loaded, the driver of that cattle truck is ultimately responsible for those cattle within that supply chain. If he's travelling through to South Australia, for example, and needs to spell those cattle, once those cattle come off the truck at the spelling yard, the spelling yard's ultimately responsible for those cattle. Once they go back onto the truck driver again becomes responsible until he gets to his end destination. And we need to have a person responsible within the supply chain at any one given time. And we can't abdicate our responsibility. The most important components in this are obviously road safety, and everyone has a role to play in that, but it's also animal welfare. And as an industry, we've tried really hard in the last 5 years to improve our record in animal welfare, and that's a critical component of everyone's business now. And our market and our customers demand high levels of animal welfare outcomes, and we want to deliver those. And by having someone responsible throughout that supply chain at any one given time, it assists us in being able to assure our customers that we are doing the right thing.
Why do you think that responsibility will be abdicated under these new laws? Because it sounds like that's exactly how things should work.
That's exactly how things should work. But a pastoralist can't control what happens in that supply chain after he's passed on responsibility through his vendor deck to the next party. So once they're on a truck and the truck's driving 500 kilometres away from his property, he can't ever possibly be responsible for what's happening in that supply chain. He can make every effort to have conversations with his truck drivers, and we've all got very good relationships with the trucking industry. They're a critical part of our business. They're a very professional part of the supply chain, and like us, they've made massive forward steps over the last 5 years. And we need to work with the trucking industry, but the trucking industry can't abdicate their responsibilities within that supply chain back to the pastoral sector.
Do you feel that these laws will enable them to do that?
They certainly have the potential to do that. Once cattle leave the territory, there are huge potentials for that to happen if something was to go wrong. And these laws principally come into play when something goes wrong. So we're relying on working with the trucking industry to make sure that the cattle are fit to load, that the right amount of cattle are there ready to go on a truck, and that the truck driver has a clear set of instructions on where to go and where to take those cattle. A truck driver will have a far better idea how long it will take for him to get from point to point, and he also needs to plan for his trip.
My understanding of chain of responsibility is that it is third parties that can influence what happens on the truck. Say the truck arrives at your place, Paul, you're running late, and therefore the truck is behind schedule, and if something did go wrong, that you did have a role to play in keeping that truck driver back. That's how I understand it to work.
Ultimately, a truck driver can make the decision whether he travels or not. And if a truck driver is going to go out of hours, or a truck driver doesn't feel comfortable in travelling because a pastoralist has been late in loading, then he needs to voice that opinion at the start of that chain of responsibility, not take it through the chain of responsibility and then all of a sudden say, well, the reason this happened was something that happened way back at the beginning of the supply chain. And it comes back a little bit to common sense.
You spoke about the animal welfare side of things and how that comes into play. Do you feel confident that each part of the supply chain can be responsible, that truck drivers can be 100% responsible for those animals?
I certainly do. And in the Northern Territory, we've proven that time and time again. Our record in animal welfare is second to none. We've made massive steps in improving infrastructure throughout the Territory. The NTCA has been heavily involved in trying to get additional rest stops for truck drivers, for improving the quality of yards at Berrima, for example. So our animal welfare record is very strong, and we want to maintain that, and we want to work with the trucking industry.
Do you think that chain of responsibility needs to be scrapped altogether then?
I think there's certainly merit in the chain of responsibility being looked at quite heavily in a livestock sense. The livestock industry is different to general freight, and we have responsibilities outside of a truck driver that will be carrying bricks or other commodities. Our commodities are live. They need to be spilled, they need to be rested, they need to be watered, they need to be fed. So we do have responsibilities throughout that supply chain from an animal welfare standard, and I think that needs to be considered more deeply with these laws coming in.
Paul Burke, he's the Chief Executive of the NT Cattlemen's Association, speaking there to Lydia Burton. These changes to the National Heavy Vehicle Laws, they come into effect as of July 1, so we'll keep a close eye on that. It is 16 past 1. Stick with us, because up next we are heading to Matarenka. A big event there on the weekend. Future rodeo stars in their thousands rocked into town to see if they could handle the potty calf ride. We'll head to Matarenka straight after this very appropriate tune by Garth Brooks. Garth Brooks and the tune Rodeo here on ABC Radio. How good is this? Kids from communities in the Roper region got their chance to try a hand at rodeo on the weekend, the rodeo school. It was put on by Territory Rodeo Services and also the Roper Gulf Regional Council as a way of engaging kids on the weekend and also promoting the pastoral industry. Our very own Dan Fitzgerald, he went along to see the kids try their luck on the back of a potty.
There is a little varmint potty calf getting its rope on now in Shoot Red.
We're bucking out in 38 degree heat, probably 87% humidity here, and these kids are keen as mustard.
I got you.
Ricky! Come on, Ricky!
name's Tara and partly owner of the Territory Rodeo Services. So the idea came about when myself and Jason, my partner, wanted to try and have a bit of a positive influence on our younger generation of the kids that are in communities around the region. We wanted to get involved, and the way we thought we could do that is by engaging them in the sport of rodeo. It's a fun sport. It has a lot of history in the Northern Territory, or in Australia as a whole, actually. It's fun and engaging and exciting, so you can really get their attention. It takes a positive attitude and a lot of willpower to be able to get on an animal. So bringing potty calves along and horses along to a rodeo event for the children brings out a lot of goodness in the child. And that's what we like to see.
What sort of skills or ideas are you trying to teach?
Well, this event in particular is in collaboration with the Roper Gulf Regional Council and with the Cattlemen's Association. They came along to talk about pathways into the industry. Sunrise Health and the ambulance are also around to talk to the kids about the health aspect of life in general. And then we come along and just try to support the whole big message of things is to try and just give a best shot at life as possible and have a positive attitude and lead healthy lives. And they're our future, and there's probably not much more important than that.
And from some of the skills you've seen from the kids today, are there any budding cowboys and cowgirls out there?
Oh, definitely. We held one here in Mataranka last year as well with some of the same kids, and they remember some of the technique and skill that Jason's been able to teach them. And, they definitely got some style about them and take part in the Mataranka rodeo and walk around with a bit of pride in them. So, yeah, no, it's good. They're definitely getting some skills behind them. And, you know, a few of them talk about leading into work in the pastoral industry, and it's all to do with animals, so it relates.
About ready, ride. What are we scoring? 85, I reckon.
That was good, Reggie.
My name is Reggie. I'm from Yelpingen.
You just had a ride? How was it?
Good. And I was painting my finger and really tight.
How did it feel when you were on the back of the potty?
Fun. And I was a little bit scared.
Did it hurt when you fell off?
No. Soft. It was soft. When I fall down.
That thing.
Because when I had that thing in my back, I didn't think I can ride that thing, but I was ready.
You didn't think you could do it?
Yeah. Well, but I just was it.
Good work. Yeah. Well done.
Daniel Kirk, Regional Manager, Community Safety, Roper Gulf Regional Council. Basically, it's a two-part story. Firstly, yesterday we did a lot of focus on healthy bodies and healthy minds, away from alcohol, away from drugs, healthy eating. And the kids played a lot of games around that. And today, that message has been reinforced through being taught the basic skills of rodeo riding. So at the moment, they're riding horses, and a little bit later this afternoon, they'll be riding steers. So the focus again, healthy mind, healthy body. You can't do this if you're not focused. And the secondary intention, particularly with the older kids that are here today, is to the staff from the station are also providing mentorship for kids that want to go into working on stations. We have the Cattlemen's Association here today as well, who are providing opportunities for young kids on their places to be mentored into station work all over the territory.
And how have you found the kids are enjoying being around the horses and the cattle?
Oh, they couldn't believe how excited they were this morning coming in, because I had the privilege of driving the bus to bring them in as well. And as soon as they saw the animals, couldn't wait. You know, very excited. They're highly motivated.
Blade Baker, the cowboy from York, England.
How good's that? Young cowboys and girls learning the ropes there at Matarenka. We heard there from Daniel Kirk from the Roper Golf Regional Council. He was speaking to Dan Fitzgerald. Well done to everyone involved in that event at Matarenka. What a beauty. And in other big news for this region, two new bridges over the Wilton and Roper rivers. They've just been opened. I think the ribbon's literally been cut as we've gone to air this afternoon. So two new bridges over the Wilton and Roper rivers. It's a project that started back in 2016. It's cost something like $50, $55 million and is really big news for Indigenous communities like Nooka and Noombawa, who normally in wet seasons get cut off for months because the old crossings went underwater and no good. But now, two brand spanking new bridges. You'll hear more about this on the Drive program this afternoon with Kate O'Toole and also on the 7 o'clock news tonight, ABC One. Time now on the Country Hour to head to the sale yards, the sale in South Australia, where some territory cattle made an appearance this week. John Traeger's got the details.
Numbers lifted as agents offered 810 head to the usual array of trade and process buyers and a much larger gallery of restockers. The yarding comprised of 300 local cattle in only fair condition, with just over 500 stalk cattle offered from Manpower Station on the Strzelecki track and Mulga Park Station, Alice Springs. Competition was good throughout the sale, with prices generally firm on the most recent sale. Killing steer quality was extremely mixed, with trade sales ranging from 238 to 260 cents, while pastoral steers returned 172 to 274 cents. Light yielding heifers traded from 150 to 220 cents, medium weights ranged from 180 to 246, with heavyweights returning 180 to 258 cents a kilo. Light brown steers traded from 170 to 250 cents, with a few heavyweights on offer ranging from 200 to a top of 258 cents. Light cows range from 140 to 190 cents, with heavy cows trading from 166 to 202 cents. Light bulls to restockers range from 128 to a top of 290 cents, with heavy bulls to the trade ranging from 200 to 222 cents a kilo. This is John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thank you for that, John. In the live export trade, the latest quote of feeder steers heading to Indonesia still sitting at around $3.20 a kilo. After the 3 o'clock news, Liz Travascus, hello.
Off to the pub, the Savo.
On a Monday.
Off to the pub.
I like your style.
Singing some songs together. Pub choir. Have you heard about it?
No, I have not.
It's been sort of gaining some traction on social media. I think most recently when 500 strangers got together to sing the Cranberries tune Zombie after yes. the lead singer passed away. It looks so much fun singing together in the pub with a bit of help from some people who know how to sing.
Do they warm up the vocal cords with a bit of amber liquor?
Well, there'd be no point doing it at the pub.
It wouldn't
otherwise,
make sense, would it?
We'll see if we can get pub choir happening in the Northern Territory, the Savo.
Get it out to the Robbery Tavern.
Yes. Perfect idea.
Beautiful. That's Liz on your radio after 3 o'clock. Thanks for your company today and keep it rural.